and with no introduction, part two. Let's hear what people, how people read Mihila and Esther. I'm so, after last week, you know, I'm nervous to hear what I'm going to find out. All the different things about Mihila and Esther. Bakasha, yeah. Dr. Kohler, let's go.
Okay, here we go. Let me share my screen again. I should probably recap a bit what we did last time. I'm sure hopefully some of you recall, some of you are exempt probably because you weren't there, and some of you may just not recall. I had to refresh my memory last night, so that'll be fine. We were talking about the basic set of beliefs that Jews in early Bayit Sheni had about Beit HaMikdash, about the restoration, about the return from Galut Bavel, about Beit David. And we were suggesting that one possible way of reading Megillat Esther was that it doesn't share in many of these beliefs and in fact rejects them. Now, I want to reiterate that I am not arguing that this is in fact the intention of the Megillah. That is a tougher question to answer. I'm suggesting that the Megillah seems to be at least questioning them, and more importantly, that it's plausible to read the Megillah as engaging in this dialogue and discussion with some of the conventional beliefs. And that is really important because what we're actually going to focus on, I hope already later today, is that some readers reacted quite violently to Megillat Esther early on because they saw it as rejecting some of the beliefs that they held to be quite central. Okay, so we're going to pick up with another couple of examples, and then we will hopefully transition to those questions of reception and reaction. The topic that we're going to move to right now, the little topic, is the question of Yehudi. Yehudi is a funny word. It's a funny word in terms of the history of Hebrew. It's a funny word in terms of how it's used today, but more importantly, in ancient times. In most of Tanakh, the meaning of Yehudi, which is not a common word at all, is straightforward. It's obvious what it means. It means someone from Yehuda. A little later on, the province around Yerushalayim in the Persian period is actually called Yehud. And so again, a Yehudi is simply someone from Yehud. In Chazal, Yehudi is not the usual word for a Jew. You know this all around Chazal. Yehudi shows up, but the regular word is Israel. Israel means a single Jewish person. It can mean the nation of Israel. So Yehudi never becomes, in ancient times, the usual word for a member of the religious group, the Jews. And yet it's used a number of times in texts from late Bayit Rishon, Galut Bavel, early Bayit Sheni, in ways that suggest that people were struggling with what exactly is a Yehudi. So I'll give you one example here from Yirmiyahu Perek Mem, where you have a fairly commonsensical use of the word. Yirmiyahu says, "V'gam kol ha'yehudim asher b'Moav uv'vnei Amon uv'Edom v'asher b'chol ha'aratzot shamu ki natan melech bavel she'irit li'huda v'chivkir alehem et Gedaliahu ben Achikam ben Shafan v'yashuvu chol ha'yehudim mikol ha'mekomot asher nidchu sham v'yavou eretz Yehuda el Gedaliahu ha'mitzpata." So immediately after the Galut, after the Churban, when Nebuchadnezzar appoints Gedaliah as the governor, then the Yehudim who had fled to neighboring lands, Amon, Moab, Edom, heard that there was now refuge in Yehuda. So the Yehudim came back to Yehuda. So this is what I mean by a commonsensical use of Yehudi. Yehudi is clearly someone from Yehuda who had left and is coming back. That's sort of straightforward. If you talk about today, say a Canadian or an American or an Israeli, those are fairly straightforward meanings. Now, it's true that you can always think of marginal cases, someone who used to be there but hasn't been there in a long time or whose parents were there. So sure, there are marginal cases. I'm sure there are marginal cases with Yehudi as well. that doesn't mean that the basic meaning of Yehudi wasn't fairly straightforward. Basically, someone from Yehuda is Yehudi. But then we get other things. We get, for example, this nevuah of Zechariah. I meant the end of the 6th century BCE. Sorry, this is towards the end of Galut Bavel. Zechariah says, I could probably change that as I'm showing my screen, but anyway. Okay, Zechariah says, well, there's going to be an end to this galut. Here's how it's going to go. V'alchu yoshvei achat el achat lemor. People from one town are going to go to the people from another town, and they're going to say, Nelcha haloch lechalot et pnei Hashem l'vakesh et Hashem tzvaot. Elcha gam ani. Let's go find the favor of God. Let's go seek out the Lord of hosts. I will also go. The many people, va'u amim rabim v'goyim atzumim l'vakesh et Hashem tzvaot b'Yerushalayim. And Zechariah here is clearly building on that very famous nevuah of Yeshayahu, and Micha, of Yeshayahu Perek Bet, the one where everyone gets up and says, Nilchal Beit Hashem. And now he continues, Ko Amar Hashem Tzvaot, Bayamim Ahema, Asher Yachaziku Asara Anashim, Mikol Lishonot Hagoyim, Ve'achziku Bechnaf Ish Yehudi, Lemor, Nilcha Imachem, Kishamanu Elohim Imachem. This is what God says. 10 men from all of the tongues, from every nation of all the peoples, will hold on to the corner, the knaf of the garment of an Ish Yehudi and say, we also want to go with you because we've heard that God is with you. Now, in this case, who's a Yehudi? This Yehudi who's returning from Galut Bavel is not from Yehuda in the straightforward sense. He's not actually born and raised in Yehuda. He has never lived in Yehuda. He's born and raised in Bavel. It's possible that his parents or grandparents came from Yehuda. But most importantly, he's on his way to Yehuda. He's someone who is choosing to go to Yehuda right now. That's the whole content of this nevuah, is that this person, whatever his origins, whatever he lives right now, he is choosing to go to Yerushalayim. That makes him an Ish Yehudi. An Ish Yehudi in Zechariah is someone with loyalty to Yehuda, whether or not he is genealogically related to Yehuda, whether or not he's ever stepped foot in Yehuda before. He probably doesn't speak the language of Yehuda. He's never seen Yehuda, but he's an Ish Yehudi by virtue of his loyalty to Yehuda, by virtue of the fact that he's choosing here to go to Yerushalayim. So Zechariah is expanding the meaning of Yehudi from someone who is from Yehuda to someone who is loyal to and devoted to Yehuda. Now, of course, this is all background for what we get in our text in Megillat Esther. So we meet our first person, Shmuel Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kishi Shimini. I skipped the first line, which is kind of important in this context. Ish Yehudi haya b'shoshan havirah. There's one grammar question here that always gets in the way of talking about this pasuk, and that's the question of who was Hoglam Yerushalayim. That vav is just pasuk vav. Who was Hoglam Yerushalayim? A lot of readers sometimes just sort of naively take it to me. A reference to Mordechai himself, that Mordechai was exiled from Yerushalayim. But that makes no historical sense on any ground. Mordechai, we mentioned the timeline last week, and I'll give you a little bit more detail later on. Mordechai is here introduced in the seventh year, or the third year, depending on when exactly, the seventh year of Achashverosh, which again puts us in the year 478 BCE, whereas the Beit HaMikdash had been destroyed in 586 BCE. So this is now 108 years after the Khorban. It is obviously highly unlikely that anyone was now living who had seen the Khorban. It's also, you sort of play it out and you realize how ridiculous it is. Not only is he unlikely to be alive, but his first cousin Esther is obviously unlikely to be a young, beautiful virgin. Like, nothing makes sense if you take that to be a reference to Mordechai being exiled. Also, he probably wouldn't have a Babylonian name, Mordechai, had he been born and raised in Yerushalayim. Luckily, the pasuk doesn't actually say that unambiguously. There's a perfectly acceptable alternative way of reading it, which is simply to take the Asher Hogla to be a reference to Kish, the last person mentioned. Mordechai ben Yair ben Shemi ben Kish, Ish Yemini Asher Hogla Yerushalayim Imagola. In other words, not Mordechai who was exiled from Yerushalayim, but his great-grandfather was exiled from Yerushalayim, which makes perfectly good sense. So then the chronology works out nicely. His great-grandfather was exiled 108 years ago. He is now a fourth-generation Babylonian Jew. He has a nice Babylonian name, Mordechai. I have no idea how old he is. I'm going to say that he's 22. That is actually a random number, but give you a sense of like where generationally he is. And the grammar absolutely allows that. And here's the point now for us. He's introduced, though, as an Ish Yehudi. Now, in what sense is he a Yehudi? He is not from Yehuda or Yehud. He's never seen Yehuda. His parents never saw Yehuda. His grandparents never saw Yehuda. It's true that his great-grandfather was an exile from Yerushalayim. Is that enough to make him a Yehudi? I don't know. Does he qualify for Zechariah's kind of Yehudi? Is he on his way back to Yerushalayim? Absolutely not. He is going to live out the rest of his days, at least as we're told in Megillat Esther, in Shushan HaBirah. So he's not physically in Yehuda. He's never come from Yehuda. He has no ties to Yehuda. He doesn't seem to be all that loyal to Yehuda. As far as we know, he never mentions Yehuda or Yerushalayim. In fact, this is something we will spend more time on in just a minute. This pasuk that you have in front of you on the screen is the one and only reference to Yerushalayim in the Megillah. The Megillah seems to be entirely uninterested in Yerushalayim and Yehuda. Obviously, Yehud, more properly, is one of the 127 provinces ruled by Ahasuerus, and that's really, really important. We'll come to that in a couple of minutes. The Ramban makes a big deal about that, but if it's mentioned, then it's only mentioned as one of the 127 provinces. There's no reference to Yerushalayim or Yehuda anywhere in this Megillah as anything special. And yet he's an Ish Yehudi. And what makes him a Yehudi? It seems like this might be a innovation of the author of Megillat Esther, expanding the category of Yehudi even more. It's not only someone from Yehuda. It's not only someone who is loyal enough to Yehuda that he's going there, as Zechariah said, but it's anyone who has some ties to the Jewish people. Now, Yehudi turns out to be a really important word in this book. I'll just sort of gesture at it, but we'll come to it in a couple of weeks, I hope. You have not only lots of Yehudim mentioned in the book, but you even have a new verb in the book later on, where we hear the Kol Amei Ha'aretz Mityahadim, a verb that has never before been used in the Hebrew language and is actually rarely used after this in the Hebrew language. Lehityahed, to either become Jewish or to act as Jews. But I just want to pay attention to how expansive the category of Yehudi is here. It's anyone who has any loyalty to, any affiliation with the Jewish people. You can't even talk that much about the religion, because as we'll see, as lots of readers have been bothered by, there's not a lot of religion in this book at all. So it's really just a question of being loyal to the Jewish people, and that makes Mordechai a Yehudi. Okay, last example here is the question of Yerushalayim and its centrality or lack thereof. So I just mentioned that the only time Yerushalayim is ever mentioned in the Megillah is in the introduction to Mordechai, where Yerushalayim is like very, very far in the background. Four generations ago, his great-grandfather was there. But there's all sorts of psukim that have been read by people as allusions to Yerushalayim. And that's because it uses all sorts of words that evoke concepts, things, places that are otherwise known primarily about Yerushalayim. So we get, for example, in Perek Aleph, when we hear that there's this incredibly ostentatious party going on in Shushan, We hear that it's decorated with chur, karpas, v'tchelet, achuz, b'chavle, v'utz, v'argaman, agli lechesef, amudei shesh, mitot zahav, lechesef, al ritzpat bahat, v'shesh, v'dar, v'socharet. Now, this is from an old commentary you see from 1908 by Lewis Patton, a doctor of divinity, in his critical and exegetical commentary on the Book of Esther, and he points out these rods formed a trellis. He's talking about our pasuk, to which the white and violet awnings were tied by the cords. The author has in mind the structure of the tabernacle in Exodus 26, 27. This is we just read last week. But there is no hint that he means this to be an allegory of the messianic feast that God will make for his people. So I agree with that last point. This is not messianic. This is much more prosaic, but Patton's putting his finger on it. The author has in mind the structure of the tabernacle. Chur karpaset techelet, chavle butz v'argaman. Where do these kind of words show up? So this is, I use the concordance function on the absolutely fantastic website alhatorah.org. And there's a lot of things that you could do on that concordance function. And hopefully everyone who learns Tanakh, or actually Torah more generally, is familiar with the website alhatorah.org. It is an immensely powerful and really amazing website. But all I did here was do a concordance search for where the word techelet and argaman show up together. And then you can see, well, which svarim does this happen in? What happens primarily in Shmot? That's what we've been reading over and over the last 2 weeks. And then in Esther, Devarei Yamim, once in Yirmiyahu Yechezkel. No, never else. That's the only places in Tanakh that the words Tchelet and Argaman show up together. So when Patton says the author has in mind the Mishkan, yeah, that's right. I mean, the combination of Tchelet and Argaman is basically, has to evoke for anyone who's read Tanakh, the Mishkan, because it shows up all the time in the Mishkan and basically nowhere else. So when we read Perek Aleph in Esther, what that means is that we're sort of brought back to the world of the Mishkan. You're like, that's interesting. So Ahasuerus's palace is sort of in some ways reminiscent of the Mishkan. Okay, interesting. I don't know what to say about that. I'm just going to leave that on the table as a little factoid and see what the author does with it. Another key word, the word bira. So again, I just used the same concordance function here. I didn't have to combine words. So bira shows up only 16 times in all of Tanakh. And as you see, only in late books, only Esther, Ezra, Nehemiah, Devarei Yamim, and Daniel. That's not an accident. It turns out that bira is borrowed into Hebrew from Akkadian through Aramaic. And it meant citadel, strong, fortified part of the city. So, okay, the fact that it's a late word is not all that important, but here's the important thing. You see that it's used in Esther, and then it's used a couple of times in Ezra, Nehemiah, Devarei Yamim, Daniel. Now, it turns out to be used about only two places in all 16 of those cases. Either Shushan HaBira, or Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash. Now, it's put in Devarei Yamim, this couldn't be, because of what I just said, it can't actually be a direct quote from David HaMelech. But in Devarei Yamim, we read that David said, when the Beit HaMikdash is being planned, Kilo la'adam habira, kila Hashem Elokim. That this bira, meaning the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, is not for humankind, it's for God. Now, whatever word David actually would have used in the 10th century, it wouldn't have been bira, but that's not the point. The point is that Devarei Yamim says, look, this bira, Yerushalayim, the Beit HaMikdash, this is God's bira, this is God's fortress. So I think it's interesting to say, like, well, that's interesting. What is the bira? Which fortress is the one that's actually most important? Is it the one in Yerushalayim, the Beit HaMikdash, which David made a big deal about, or is it the one in Shushan? Which is the bira? Now, this is where the Ramban comes in. Because the Ramban, who, as you might know, is a very, very smart person. In his Chidushim on Masechet Megillah, asks a really sort of obvious, basic question. It's like, why is Purim such a weird holiday? Why do we have these 2 days and it depends where you are? Like, that's strange. That's not a normal holiday. We don't say that Pesach is, you know, on one date if you happen to be in the Sinai Peninsula, but a different date if you're in Israel or if you're in North America. Like, you know, it doesn't really normally matter what happened where, when someone would have heard. Like, why don't we have one day and make it a normal holiday? And the Ramban, I'm not going to get to his full answer, but in order to answer that question, the Ramban says, look, I checked more, just based on Tanakh, I checked more into the political realities of the Jews at the time of the story of Esther. Now, how do I do that, says the Ramban? The Ramban, actually, we know from elsewhere, would have loved to have archaeology. He's really interested in archaeology. When he gets to the land of Israel and he discovers things, he's really interested in that. But he doesn't have archaeology of the time. So he says, well, I studied Ezra Nehemiah really carefully to understand the political reality. He says, you see the passage here. So again, this is Chidushim. The Ramban, unfortunately, didn't write a commentary on Megillat Esther. That would be awesome. But we do have his Chidushim on Shas. Not all of Shas. But anyway, this is a Masachat Megillah. At the very beginning, he says, "Kshe'iyanti baktuvim, nityashev li ha'inyan yafeh. Lefishu davar barur, shebizmano shal nezeh, kvar nifkidu Yisrael va'alu la'aretz berishyon koresh v'nityashvu ba'arehem." So he makes the point that actually came up last week. Rabbi Kelman mentioned this at the end of last week. Ramban said, look, I studied Ezra Nehemiah really carefully, and it became clear to me that when the miracle of Esther happened, B'nai Israel had already gone back to Israel with the permission of Koresh. This is after Koresh. Okay, great. So then what do I know about the Jews in Yerushalayim? Well, here's what I know. K'shetziva Achashverosh la'ashmid l'harog l'abed, Hayu haprazim v'harayot she'ein lahem choma saviv b'safek v'sakana gdola shelo ya'alu alehem oivim yoter min hamukafim. Now, who's in most danger? The unwalled cities are clearly in most danger in throughout the empire because they're not protected from all of the potential enemies around them. Right? Theoretically, if Yerushalayim had a powerful wall, then the Jews in Yerushalayim would be able to say, okay, look, I heard about the genocidal decree, sure, Haman, blah, blah, blah. But what do we care? We have these gates, we're going to close the gates, and we're not going to worry about it, right? Our neighbors might be mad, but they're obviously not going to be able to burst through the gates of a powerful, defended, walled city. But, the Ramban says, I know from Sefer Nehemiah that Yerushalayim doesn't have a wall. I know that because Nehemiah builds the wall. And Nehemiah is later than this. So Nehemiah, you might recall from Perek Bet, says he hears that Yerushalayim is undefended and he goes and he builds the wall. And then his neighbors are in fact mad that he does have a wall. But this is all decades later. So Ramban says, ah, so I understand. Yerushalayim was particularly vulnerable in the time of Mordechai and Esther because there are Jews there, but they're undefended. And we know from Ezra and Nehemiah that they do have enemies round about. Nehemiah seems to be remarkably unpopular, actually, among his enemies. He has these three enemies who just don't like him. And it's never, since all we have is Nehemiah's perspective, we never quite hear why they don't like him. But they really don't like him. So in the time of Mordechai and Esther, Yerushalayim is really, really vulnerable. Now, for the Ramban, I said I'm not going to get to the full answer. He says that's why Yerushalayim has special standing for Purim. Why we have Shushan Purim, which has nothing to do with Shushan anymore. It has to do with Yerushalayim, because Yerushalayim had special vulnerability. But here's the key point that I want to take away from what the Ramban is pointing out to us. Yep. Yerushalayim is entirely vulnerable here and entirely dependent on what happens in Shushan. Yerushalayim can't defend itself in the times of Mordechai and Esther. She has no walls. She has no defenses before Ezra and Nehemiah. They haven't strengthened and fortified the city all that much. And so paradoxically, or maybe for the Megillah not so paradoxically, the important scene, in other words, if you want to know what the future of Jewish people is, that's not taking place in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is dependent entirely on what happens in Shushan. So you want to know where you should be paying attention? Where the action on the screen should stay, don't look at Yerushalayim. What happens in Yerushalayim will only depend on what happens in Shushan. Where's the real Bira? In other words, the power has shifted from Yerushalayim, which sure should be the Bira, but it's not. The power is now in the halls of the palace in Shushan. Jews will live and die not based on what happens in Yerushalayim, but what happens in Shushan. So the Megillah not paying attention to Yerushalayim could be read as really quite subversive, because the Megillah is essentially saying, or at least could be read as saying, oh, Yerushalayim, sure, that's a, look, there are a lot of Jews there, you know, we care about Yerushalayim, there's a Beit HaMikdash there, it all matters. But the fate of the Beit HaMikdash does not depend on what happens to the Jews in Yerushalayim. It doesn't depend on what the Jews in Yerushalayim do. You know who's determining the fate of the Jews in Yerushalayim? The Jews in Shushan. If Mordechai and Esther can beat Haman 700 miles away, then Yerushalayim will be safe. If Mordechai and Esther lose to Haman, Yerushalayim will be overrun by their enemies. But the important action, the important activity, takes place over here in the diaspora in Shushan. That's the real Bira. And if you want to know, you know, where am I thinking about Tchelet V'Argaman? Well, all of that has shifted to Shushan. Shushan is the most important city in the world right now, not only politically, but for Jewish history. Not because there are more Jews there, but because the Jews there determine the fate of the Jews everywhere. So again, I don't know if this is what the Megillah is arguing, but reading it this way is sort of an APAC kind of reading. Right? It's like, well, what happens in Israel? Well, that depends on what happens in Washington, right? Like, who do you have to pay attention to? Sure, Israel. Of course, Israel. It's an independent country, absolutely. But, I'm not saying this today or in yesteryear, but it could be read as saying that actually what really matters is what happens in the halls of power and those big capitals across the sea. That's what really is going to determine the fate of the Jews here in Yerushalayim, because they are actually powerless. As the Ramban said, they don't have a wall. They don't have defenses. They're dependent on what happens in Shushan. So all of this would be a really quite subversive reading of the politics of Megillat Esther, which would be arguing that, in fact, when we read elements in Perek Aleph in Megillat Esther that are reminiscent of the Beit HaMikdash, reminiscent of Yerushalayim, calling it a Bira, talking about the Tchelet V'Argaman, that's reminiscent of Yerushalayim, because the author might be saying, forget Yerushalayim. That's not what matters anymore. Tchelet Argaman, Bira, it's all shifted over here. Now the place that matters is here in Shushan. And just to add to that way of interpreting it, so we have, we're going to sort of shift from Yerushalayim to God, which of course are interconnected. So we have lines like, very familiar from Ashrei, I could have picked many, many psukim, but and later, Kvod Malchutcha Yomeru Gvot Chaye Deberu. So the Gdula, the Kvod Malchuto of Hashem, well, where do we see that here? Baharoto et Osher Kvod Malchuto, Betikar Tiferet Gdulato. This is from Esther Perek Aleph, but who's this about? This is not the Gdula of Hashem. This is not the Kvod Malchut of Hashem. This is the Kvod Malchut and Gdula of Achashverosh. So this could be read as even more subversively arguing that the Gdula and the Kvod HaMalchut that properly belong to God and the Beit HaMikdash have been usurped by Achashverosh in Shushan. In other words, where do you go to see the glory of the majesty of a grand building ruled by a mighty monarch? Well, that's supposed to be a description of the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. But in fact, the Megillah usurps that description and applies it to the palace of Achashverosh and Shushan HaBira. The Gedula, the Kvod HaMalchut. All these key words that ring a bell to us, because like, right, those are descriptions of God. Those are descriptions of the temple that are supposed to evoke the glory of God, but here repurposed as if to suggest, and again, I'm not at all sure this is right, but as if to suggest that in fact that glory of the Beit HaMikdash has been usurped here by the glory of Shushan, Achashverosh's palace. And I think this is a lot, you know, there's just a, I don't think we're going to come back to this, so I'll just throw it out here. Now, there's a series of midrashim, really fascinating midrashim, that almost tell a biography of the throne of Shlomo HaMelech. And there's lots of different versions of it. Some of them actually show up in the Targum to Megillat Esther. We have these two very long Targumim to Megillat Esther, which are not lokonklus, like word for word. They contain lots of expansive midrashim. Anyway, but the story of the throne of Shlomo is told in a number of midrashim. And the key point is that these midrashim say that Ahasuerus had inherited the throne of Shlomo. You also have the very famous midrash that when the Megillah says that Ahasuerus brought out Bichelim, Mikelim, Shonim, we read in that tune because it's a reference to clay Beit HaMikdash. Now, there's no reason in the pshat to think that it's clay Beit HaMikdash, but what are Chazal doing by saying that Ahasuerus has Shlomo's throne, or by saying that Ahasuerus has the clay HaMikdash in Shushan? I think what they're doing is saying there's a lot that connects the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim that's here been moved to the palace in Shushan. In other words, what I'm picking up on here in terms of the words, the Gdula and the Kvod HaMalchut, the Tchilet and the Aragaman, the Bira, Chazal are also picking up on, not surprisingly, and they're concretizing it by saying, no, literally, some of the things that used to be in Yerushalayim, that used to be in the Beit HaMikdash, the throne of Shlomo HaMelech, or the Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash, they are now physically moved to the palace of Ahasuerus and Shushan. And what they're trying to say is, Perek Aleph in Megillat Esther sounds a lot like a description of the Beit HaMikdash. Now, why does Perek Aleph sound a lot like the description of the Beit HaMikdash? There is where interpretation comes in, not just observation. And again, what I'm saying here is that the most subversive way of reading this would be to say that the author is arguing that, in fact, that's because the center of power, the center of Jewish life, has in fact moved from Yerushalayim to Shushan. That's certainly not the only way of reading it. We will see other ways of reading it, but that would be the most subversive way of reading it. Okay, and I said we're using this to transition from Yerushalayim to the question of God. And here, of course, the most, probably the most famous, but also the most important fact about Megillat Esther is that there is no God in Megillat Esther. And I mean that just as a literal statement. God is never mentioned. God may be hinted at in all sorts of ways, and we will see lots of in the coming weeks, we will find lots of ways in which readers have discerned God's presence in Megillat Esther, but nowhere is God actually mentioned. But it's more than that. It's more than that. It's not only that God is not mentioned, it's that God is replaced. So what do I mean by that? So we have an idiom throughout Tanakh that people, especially enemies, were terrified and didn't do anything because essentially nafal pachad Hashem aleihem. So we get this already back in Shirat Hayam, Tipol Alehem Matava Fachad, Bigdol Zeruacha Yidmuka Aven. Then we have it in Shmuel Aleph, Vayipol Pachad Hashem Al Ha'am, Vayitzu Ki Ish Echad, that's about Bnei Yisrael. In Devarei Yamim, we have this often. Bnei Yisrael defeat the people, Ki Haya Pachad Hashem Alehem, or Vayhi Pachad Hashem Al Kol Mamlechot Ta'aratzot Asher Sivot Yehuda. And so on and so on. Like over and over, the pachad of God fell on Israel's enemies. What about in the Megillah? Kinafal pachad hayehudim alehem. Or v'ishlo amad lifnehem, kinafal pachdam al kol ha'amim. Or kinafal pachad Mordechai alehem. Here, over and over, the same basic idiom. The enemies were cowed into terror because nafal pachad aleihem, except that it's not the pachad of God. It's the pachad of the Jews or the pachad of Mordechai that falls on the enemies. And that is an idiom that never shows up anywhere other than Esther. That the fear of the Jews fell on their enemies is not anything we would find anywhere else. And I'm reminded here of the quote-unquote traditional, super untraditional Hanukkah song, Mi Yimaleh Gvurot Yisrael, Otam Mi Yimneh, right? Which is sung in rounds and is great. But Mi Yimaleh Gvurot Yisrael is an incredibly subversive song. Because what's the actual pasuk? It's not Mi Yimaleh Gvurot Yisrael. Who will tell, who will recite the mighty deeds of Israel. What's the actual line? Miyim ala gvurot Hashem, otam miyim ne. Right? So the song, the modern song, replaces the gvurot of Hashem with gvurot Yisrael, in keeping with a modern ethos that Israel, the Jews, have in fact done a lot. That replacement, which is, you know, become a that's why I say, you know, quote unquote traditional song, that replacement is exactly the same dynamic that we have here in the Megillah, where Nafal Pachar Yudim Alehem, like every traditional Jew would have heard that and been like, wait, what? I'm sorry. You can just take God out of the picture here and say Nafal Pachar Yudim Alehem. That's got to be Nafal Pachar Hashem Alehem. That's the whole idiom. That's the whole point. The enemies are cowed into terror by the fear of God falling on them. So what I want to emphasize is that the Megillah, not only does the Megillah not mention God, but seems to actively replace God with Israel. That Israel does what God used to do, literally. What the import of all of this is yet to be teased out. But again, the thing to emphasize is that you can well imagine lots of readers reading this, picking up on all of these things, picking up on the replacement of Yerushalayim by Shushan, picking up on the omission of God and the replacement of God by the Jews, and being really quite furious. You're like, what? Like, what is going on here? Like, this is a terrible, terrible book. And that's on top of what we talked about earlier, the lack of Beit David being replaced by Shaul, the intermarried queen who doesn't eat kosher, all these different things, which would make lots of readers just recoil. So maybe there's an answer to all of this. In other words, maybe I'm reading it wrong and actually, it has to be turned on its head for some reason. But you can imagine some readers just reading this and being like, this is just terrible. This is unredeemable. Now, I want to give you just one quick example before we actually turn to another big source. One quick example of readers who saw it exactly in these ways and did recoil. But this is a really recent set of readers. This is a pamphlet that, as far as I only know of one copy that exists. I'm sure someone must have in their houses somewhere. But a colleague, Professor Yael Zerubbabel, who's at Rutgers, and I talked about this maybe like 15 years ago. We dug this up in the National Archives and the Hebrew University Library. This is, you can see, published at the bottom. You can see at the bottom here, published in Warsaw, 1937, by Beitar in Poland. So Beitar, you know about Beitar. So Beitar is the, you know, it's self-defense and somewhat militaristic Jewish youth movement in Europe, which of course this is 1937. So it all comes, you know, everything's under a tragic cloud in retrospect. But actually, the most important thing about this pamphlet, I'll show you the table of contents in a second. But the most important thing about this pamphlet is actually the title. You see the title, Shnei Moadim. Yud Aleph Adar, Semel HaYahadut HaMechudeshet. So Yud Aleph Adar, what is Yud Aleph Adar? Anyone remember? If you live in Israel, you might you have a better chance of remembering. So that's the fall of Tel Chai, when Trumpeldor and six people were killed defending Tel Chai in 1920. That's Yud Aleph Adar. It's still, as Trumpeldor's yahrzeit, so to speak. I mean, it is yahrzeit. It's still marked on the calendar in Israel. I don't know if anyone pays attention. But Purim, Semel HaYahadut HaGalutit. Now, the pamphlet actually argues, essentially, to stop celebrating Purim and start celebrating Chag Tel Chai on Yud Aleph Adar. Because Purim, according to the pamphlet, is a essentially depraved diaspora holiday. It's a holiday that only diaspora Jews could possibly celebrate because essentially of all the things that we just mentioned. There's no redemption. There's no Yerushalayim. There's no self-determination. You're at the whim of the king and his evil advisor. The queen is intermarried. The Jews are not independent. The Jews can't defend themselves. It's a terrible holiday. So that you're going to celebrate? So sure, I get it. If you're a diaspora Jew, you celebrate that. But now, 1937 Warsaw. We don't have to be diaspora Jews anymore. We shouldn't celebrate any more of these sort of second-rate holidays that only celebrate the fact that we didn't get massacred at the kind will whim of a madman king. That's not a kind of holiday we want to celebrate anymore. Now we want to celebrate Tel Chai. Remember, Tel Chai, we lost, right? I mean, we. Trumpeldor died. Tel Chai didn't defend itself. Later it did, but in any event, it's not a celebration of a great victory, but it's the kind of celebration that would commemorate exactly the values that Beitar wants us to commemorate, which is you fight for your land to the death. It means dying, it means dying. But we absolutely are not going to be subject to the whim of a foreign potentate who's going to decide, you know, yes or no to kill us all or not, based on whether the evil advisor has his way or not. This is terrible. This is diaspora Judaism. Now we have Semel Yadut HaMechudeshet, and for that we should cancel Purim and start celebrating Tel Chai. So I want to lead with this, and maybe we'll come back to it when we get to Purim in modern Israel in a few weeks. But I want to lead with this because I think it makes it very clear that lots of readers, whether they liked it or not, have seen Purim as a very diasporic holiday, not centered in Yerushalayim, not centered on self-determination, not centered on a redemption and a return, but centered on just survival in the diaspora. Now, this particular pamphlet, not surprisingly, this Beitar pamphlet, looks at that and says that's exactly what it is, therefore we need to reject it. Other Jews over the course of history, and these are things that we will play out over the coming weeks, other Jews said that's exactly right. That's why it's the only holiday that's meaningful for us here in the diaspora. So Jews in North Africa or in Europe said, right, you know, of all the holidays, we can dream about another Pesach. But Purim, that we get. We too have experienced things like Purim. So Purim is the holiday that speaks most directly to us. And then there have been Jews who said, no. I like Purim. I don't like the diaspora, so I need to reread this entirely. And this is not what the Megillah means at all. Maybe it means something totally different. So these are all things that we will start to see over the coming weeks. Okay, I'm going to actually pause here because I see that I'm going to open the chat and see what we have. and then we'll hopefully go to the next bunch of sources. Okay. Unfortunately, I don't know exactly when everyone wrote these chats. So if you responded to something directly, I may or may not know exactly what you have in mind. It's a high duty to be someone who's descended from Jews. Yeah. So Alana, your point's quite good. That's probably right. But I think the deployment of Yehudi there specifically for someone who's going to Yerushalayim indicates that he means that it's more than just someone who is descended from Jews. But you're specifically holding on to the knaf of an ish Yehudi, meaning someone who's on his way to Yerushalayim. But you're absolutely right. It's Zechariah is not nearly as radical as I think the Megillah is. Right. So iPad. Excellent point, iPads. Yeah, they said the computers are best in humans. So iPad made an excellent point here. In a time with no separation between religion and state, a different form of identity is evolving here. I think that's really, really important. I don't know that we'll return to that explicitly, but I think you're absolutely right that Jews didn't have to grapple all that much with the question of what it meant to be a Jew until they were in exile in their homeland. If they say, well, it's obvious, you know, if you live in Israel and you go to the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim and you speak Hebrew and you keep Shabbos, so they're like, I don't know, like how many follow-up questions do I need to ask you? You know, like Ruth says, like that seems to be the key point, right? I'm going to be in Beit Lechem. I'm going to speak Hebrew. I'm going to worship your God. Like that's kind of all I need. What about in the diaspora, though? Then the questions become much more intense. And they're questions that have followed us for the last 2,500 years. Of course, now in modern Israel, they're questions also. But one could argue that's because we've imported diaspora questions into a modern state of Israel. In other words, one could argue, and I certainly don't want to argue this, not now anyway, but one could argue, look, let's go back to that Amecha Mi Elohai Ech Elohai kind of Jewish identity. You know, you come from the Soviet Union, you raise your kids speaking Hebrew, send them to the army, and they even spend a year in Mechina. Okay, like that's all kind of all we need to ask. Was your mother's mother Jewish? I don't know. Does that matter? So of course that's if I did argue that, I would be in big trouble. At least in some circles. I don't know about the people on this. But anyway, but that would be a fraught argument of returning to that sort of identity in modern Israel. And of course, you know, we as religious Jews have not returned to that sort of identity, but it's a complicated question, because when you have sovereignty and you have a country, there are obvious symbols of identity that don't have to do with genealogy. So yeah, iPad, that was an excellent point. Okay, I'm gonna leave aside the chronology question, because we will come back to that probably in a week or two. All right, I'm going to set aside the Yehudim questions as well, just to not belabor that point. Yeah, Epi, it's a great point about the rabbinic commentaries and the interior decoration of the palace and the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, right, so I think Epi's kind of putting his finger on a key question, where he says, is the author happy about the power of Shushan, or is he critical of that? That is a fantastic question. That's something that I'm not taking a stand on here, and I actually don't know how to answer. So that's something that we will see readers responding to in different ways. That's, you know, exactly the key point. Okay. I'm sorry there's interference. I hope that's not true anymore. Okay, fantastic. So we'll now move on. Da-da-da-da. There we go. So we have, where is this? I apologize. Hopefully, well, I actually don't know if everyone downloaded this, but on the Torah in Motion website is our first source sheet, which is just one source. Now I have to share, I'm going to share my screen to make sure that everyone has it. Where's my screen? Here we go. Ah, okay. And this is excerpts from the Greek additions to the Book of Esther. Now this is, maybe the existence of them is the most fascinating thing here. So we have to give a little bit of an introduction to this, and then we'll get into some of the details. If you ask what the earliest evidence we actually have for the Book of Esther is, in other words, not when I think it was written, but like, when's the first time we have empirical evidence, like someone quoting the Book of Esther, someone mentioning the Book of Esther, the first time we have empirical evidence for the Book of Esther, it actually comes from the Greek version of the Book of Esther, which ends with a colophon. Colophon, as you may know, in manuscripts or in a text, is the ending where a scribe or a copyist says, this was written by, this was copied by me sitting here in wherever I was, the year 5782, whatever. So, of course, it can contain a lot more interesting information than that as well. It can tell you who I am, how I got this book. It can contain all sorts of information. But, sorry, let me make sure I have this. Actually, let me stop this sharing screen and put up the exact thing that we need. The Greek translation, of course, we have a Greek translation of all of Tanakh, right? This is often goes by the name the Septuagint. The Septuagint is itself, like technically the word refers to 70, the 70 that is, of course, a reference to this story that we find both in Chazal, in the Gemara and Megillah, and in an earlier text called the Letter of Aristeus, a Beit Sheni text, that tells a story of there being 70 or 72 sages who were brought in by the King Ptolemy to translate the Torah into Greek. So technically that only refers to the Torah itself. And this Septuagint technically sort of refers only to the translation of the Torah. But of course, conventionally or more colloquially, whatever. Anyway, the term Septuagint refers to all the whole Greek translation of Tanakh. So we have the Greek translation of all of Tanakh, but the translations were made at different times with different people. Now, the Greek translation of Esther, uniquely among all of the books of Tanakh, has a colophon, and it says, it actually dates itself. It says that this letter of Purim was translated by Lysimachus in Yerushalayim in the fourth year of Ptolemy and Cleopatra, and was brought to Alexandria by two men named Dositheus and Ptolemy, priests from Yerushalayim. Lots of information here. So it was translated by a guy named Lysimachus in Yerushalayim, translated from Hebrew to Greek. We get a date, the fourth year of Ptolemy and Cleopatra. Come back to that in 1 second. And then it was brought from Yerushalayim to Alexandria by two Kohanim, whose names are Dositheus and Ptolemy. Now the date, historians have said, well, you know, we have, 13 Ptolemies. So like, which one was this? So doing a little bit of arithmetic and figuring out how many Ptolemies there were, who also Cleopatra, who lived to 4 years. So it has to have been Ptolemy the 12th, who comes to the throne of Egypt in 80 BCE, which means that the translation of Esther is dated pretty specifically to 77, 76 BCE. So the translation of Esther is made in Yerushalayim in 77 BCE, and then brought to Alexandria, translated by Kohen in Yerushalayim. Now, who's ruling Yerushalayim in 77 BCE? I don't need a name necessarily, but a dynasty would be great. You can put it in the chat if it comes to mind.
Herodians?
No, not yet. Herod doesn't come until 40 BCE.
Maccabees?
Yeah, exactly. The Hashmonaim. Yeah. The Hashmonaim. Fantastic. So the Hashmonaim are in charge, right? They rule from, depending on when you start them exactly, but you know, basically 161, 164 BCE is Hanukkah. That's not the end of the wars. Let's say 164 till 63 BCE. When the civil war that's Chazal tell us about and that we hear about from Josephus also leads to the end of the Hasmonean dynasty. So 77, we're in the middle of the Hasmonean dynasty. Now, let's think for a second about the Hashmonaim and what they would think about a book like we just described. A book that says the center of power is off in Shusha, that we're dependent on the Persians' goodwill to determine whether or not we can live in our homeland. That, you know, what matters is not the Jews in Israel fighting, but who roams the halls of power 700 miles away. I mean, this is antithetical to essentially everything that the Hashmonaim believe. You can add in also, I think probably not as a minor point, the fact that Esther is intermarried, the fact that Esther doesn't make any effort to eat kosher food even after she reveals herself as queen. Remember the stories in the books of Maccabees that were where the king says, you know, eat this pig, and they die rather than eat the pig, right? So I said last week, Esther always has a choice. The Hashmonaim may have been the ones who would say, you know what, Esther, you had a choice. And what you should have done is martyr yourself rather than become the queen intermarried in Persia. Like, this is despicable. They're the ones who first tell us stories of martyrdoms. The first martyr stories are in the books of Maccabees. There is nothing about the book of Esther that the Hashmonaim would have liked as it stands, like without interpretation. Now, again, I don't know that that's what the book of Esther was arguing. So the Hashmonaim have essentially two options. They can either reject the book of Esther and say, this is just a terrible book. Like, we can't tolerate this kind of book. I mean, this book is terrible. Our daughters might grow up to think you can intermarry. Kashrus is not important. You know, Yerushalayim is not, all these things. They fought for the Beit HaMikdash. Megillat Esther doesn't care about the Beit HaMikdash. Like, all these things, right? Point after point. So one possibility would just be, like, reject the book. But another possibility would be to interpret the book. Now, you know the joke about the Yiddish version of Shakespeare that was translated and improved? Verteicht und verbessert. So that's essentially what we get in the Greek version of Esther. We're going to get a Greek version that is not just translated into Greek, but is improved. And I'm going to put improved in quotation marks, not because I don't think it was improved, but because obviously it's a matter of opinion as to whether this is an improvement or not. But what we get is six long additional passages in the Greek version of Esther that change the story fairly significantly. So it starts at the very beginning of the story. And let me put those sources back up. Okay. So you see here, this is how the story, I resized you, but now I can't see the text. Here we go. This is how the book actually opens. And I should say the Greek version, you can find this easily online. Just search for like Greek version Esther or something, Greek editions Esther. But it's, as with the rest of the Septuagint, it was the Christian version of the book for about 1500 years. Luther, who compared the Christian version of the book to the Hebrew version of Tanakh, and took out things that he found were not actually in the Jewish Hebrew version of Tanakh, took it out. So this is now in the Catholic version of Esther, but not in the Protestant version of Esther. For the people other than Catholics, this is in a collection called the Apocrypha, which for Christians are still a very important collection. And actually for Jews, they're a very important collection, but mostly for Jewish history, they're not sacred at all for us. So in any event, if you open a Catholic version of Esther, it starts like this. In the second year of the reign of Ahasuerus the Great, on the first day of Nisan, Mordechai, son of Yair, son of Shimi, son of Kish, of the tribe of Benjamin, had a dream. He was a Jew living in the city of Shushan, a great man serving in the court of the king. He was one of the captives of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon had brought from Jerusalem with King Yechoniah of Judah, which I think is a mistaken reading, but that's not the point right now. This was his dream. Noises and confusion, thunders and earthquake, tumult on the earth. Then two great dragons came forward, both ready to fight, and they roared terribly. At their roaring, every nation prepared for war to fight against the righteous nation. It was a day of darkness and gloom, of tribulation and distress, affliction and great tumult on the earth. And the whole righteous nation was troubled. They feared the evils that threatened them. They were ready to perish. And they cried out to God, and at their outcry, as though from a tiny spring, there came from a great river with abundant water. Light came. The sun rose. The lowly were exalted and devoured those held in honor. Mordechai saw in this dream what God had determined to do. And after he awoke, he had it on his mind, seeking all day to understand it in every detail. So that is the very beginning of the book. Before we get anything about Shushan, about the Vashti, about anything else, we hear about Mordechai's dream. The very end of the book, I'm not going to read this part, but at the end, Mordechai says, now I get it all. This was all the dream I had. The two great dragons were me and Haman. The river was Esther, who brought peace to the earth. And God has done great signs and wonders, and so on. So that's the frame of the book. Now, what does this do for the book? How does this change it? I said it's for Tyson and for Besser. How does this change it? You can put it in the chat if you have some ideas. Oh, so Susanna already said, reminiscent of scenes of dreams in Bereshit. Fantastic. Let's be a little bit more specific. Whose dreams in Bereshit?
Well, Yosef and Paro.
Yosef and Paro, right, exactly. So in other words, assuming that Mordechai is not meant to be associated here with Paro, which I think is plausible, it's Yosef the dreamer and Yosef the dream interpreter. But absolutely, Mordechai is being associated here with Yosef. Now, readers always associated Esther with Yosef for very, very good reason. So we'll put that on the table. But this is making Mordechai a sort of new Yosef. So that's fantastic. What else? Even more general. Oh, Tova just said, fantastic. Tova said, I think it's absolutely right that it compares Mordechai with Yosef, but more generally, it tells you that all of these events were divinely orchestrated from the beginning, which is absolutely not clear in the Megillah itself. You could absolutely read the Megillah as a study in randomness. Literally, he casts lots and decides, he happens to have met Mordechai at the gate. There's no God, so there can't be Hashkacha Pratit in the Megillah. Not according to this version. According to this version, the whole Megillah, it was plotted out from the beginning. And before we ever knew what happened, we knew that God had orchestrated that it would happen. So that is fantastic. Now we have to pause here before we get to the other Greek additions. You have the sources, so we're going to start with next week. Is two other additions, you have them here, that are put into the middle of the Megillah, that reframe not Mordechai, who has already been reframed by the beginning of the book, but Esther. Because Esther, of course, is to some extent even more problematic a character than Mordechai. for people who would believe all the things that we were talking about. So they have to really redeem Esther, and that's what we'll start with next week. Okay, so I'm going to pause here, stop my share screen. Let me see the chat if there was more to bring in here. 70, no, that's a great point. Yosef was also outside of Israel, right? Fantastic. Yeah, so this, Naomi, that's a really wonderful point. There's a lot to associate Mordechai and Esther with Yosef in the Pshat already, which Chazal already pointed out. And I think the Greek version is simply sort of developing that even more and saying, well, one thing that Yosef did that Mordechai doesn't do is have dreams that reveal the will of God. So let's put that in as well. And of course, that changes the character of Mordechai and also the story. Okay, fantastic. All right, so I will leave it there. We will pick up again with the character of Esther next time. Until then, Purim Katan Sameach. Shushan Purim Katan is actually Shira's and my wedding anniversary, which I only know because we actually didn't fast on the day of our wedding because it was Shushan Purim Katan. Like, you know, whatever. Trivia. But anyway, so yeah, enjoy the week. Enjoy this.
I assume you're coming up to your silver anniversary. Am I correct?
Almost. We got married in 2000.
I said coming up. Okay. In 3 years. Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Very good. Mazel tov. Okay.
It was a lot relevant to the topics of this, of today's class. It was also the year that my parents moved to Israel. Took the Yehudi aspect there. So it's, 2000.
And your father's online shopping nakasik who bought Bivrit. Okay. All right, guys, 27 minutes. Go get a cup of coffee in 27 minutes. Rachel Sharansky Danziger begins her series on the ins and outs of liberty. I'm sure many of you here have heard her in the past. If not, I invite you to come. She's has a degree in philosophy and storytelling. She's very creative and interesting. So that's in 27 minutes from now at 11 a.m. I will I'll keep the chat on. You don't have to you don't have to re-enter. You can turn off your screen and just come back at 11. And then at 1 p.m., Alex Israel will be giving his class. So a morning and afternoon of learning Alex Israel, continuing his series on Eliyahu, Prophet of Fire. And then tomorrow, Menachem Kellner continues his series on the Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda Levi attitude towards non-Jews at 11 a.m. And then at 2 p.m., we go to Rome, Italy, virtually, and where Mark Shapiro will be interviewing the Rabbi of Rome. Please God, we'll be going in the summer. That's what we're touring some of the Jewish communities we've been to. So tomorrow at 11 and 2, and then 8 p.m., of course, Dr. Sokolow will give his class on the evolving of Tanakh. And Thursday morning, Malka Simkowicz finishes her series at 10:30 on the Jews of ancient Egypt, and Shuli Mishkin at 12 o'clock on biblical archaeology, the time period of Nevi'im Rishonim. And then at 8:30 p.m., Rabbi Mordechai Turchiner will be giving the weekly Parshat HaShavua Shir. And then at 9 a.m. Friday morning, I'll conclude the week with my regular Shir on the Siddur. So we look forward to learning with you. And please, as always, bring a friend. And okay, have a great day. We'll hopefully see you now in 25 minutes. Boy, I see how quickly time passes. Okay, everybody be well. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.